Alberto, so Peter, your turn.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me? It's working.
Yes.
Sorry for being late. So the topic of my talk is probabilistic analysis of condition numbers. To start, let me recall a little bit from the first talk what Felipe has explained to us. So let me talk a little bit about condition-based analysis. Okay, so we assume we have some input, which is a vector of real numbers of length n, and then we have some algorithm, some numerical algorithm, which takes tx of epsilon steps. Epsilon is some accuracy that we want to have, and this is the running time or number of steps of an algorithm on input x. Okay? And we would like to analyze the running time of this algorithm and come up with an estimate of the following form. So this is very general, but we would like to bound the running time in terms of the size of the input. The size is just n, plus, say, logarithm of 1 over epsilon, epsilon the accuracy, plus a quantity measuring the condition of our input, which is just denoted by cond of x. Okay, say to some constant. So we would like to have this polynomial bound in the size of the input, the condition, and this accuracy. Okay. So this is not a theorem, this is something we want to achieve. And Felipe showed us one important example where you can actually have this. An important example is the conjugate gradient method, which allows you to solve a system of equations, Ax equals b when a is positive definite. Okay, it's quite a sophisticated algorithm, and you can bound the number of steps essentially by the square root of the classical matrix condition number times log 1 over epsilon. So this is one example of such a condition-based analysis, which is important. Let's go to another important situation, namely the situation of linear programming. So in my talk, I want to really want to be as basic as possible. So I just look at the feasibility problem and homogeneous case. So I assume that my input is a matrix A, n times m. I'm still above the red line, I think. Still okay. Okay, so maybe looks like this. This is A, the matrix. We have. But it doesn't matter because it's just part of the. Right, so n greater than m. And the question is this, I think, the question is the feasibility problem. Does there exist a vector y in R to the m such that a times y is less than or greater, doesn't matter, less than 0, component wise? So we have here a bunch of homogeneous linear inequalities. You may think of n being much bigger than m. Okay? Good. Right. And yesterday we heard the first talk by Renato Montero about interior point methods. There are interior point methods that solve this problem. Actually, this is the dual version of the problem. One could also write the primal, so actually the algorithm decides whether the dual or the primal is feasible. And the running time, I can bound in the following way. There is an interior point method deciding, okay, this problem, or its alternative, with a running time t of a bounded by some constant square root of n logarithm of n plus the logarithm of something, a measure of conditioning. Okay. So this c of a is a variant of Jim Renegade's condition number. This variant here is called the GCC condition number. GCC standing for Goffin, Cheung, and Cooker. So variant of Renegade's condition number. So I chose the GCC because I know most about it. Well, this is the one I understand better, and it's better to analyze. There is no epsilon here. Yes, I expected this comment. Yes. The epsilon, you have to have the epsilon if you want to compute something approximate. But this is decision. And for this problem, you don't even need to have an epsilon if you are computing with infinite precision. There's no epsilon here. Okay. So this C of A, maybe you remember in Felipe's talk towards the end, he even gave the definition of this notion. So this notion is defined in terms of inverse distance to the set of ill-posed systems. Okay, but I don't want to go and recall the definition, but we just see that this is an estimate of this type. Okay, it's a condition-based analysis. Now, So the problem is here, the problem with these kind of estimates is that we don't know the condition beforehand. So and here this is kind of a departure from people maybe in discrete mathematical theoretical computer science would do. So I'm in a math department, but I talk a lot to the computer science people, and this is something that say maybe they don't understand so well, or they have a different. In their view, the matrix A has integer coefficients, and then you can actually bound this quantity here by a polynomial in the bit input size, and then you have an upper bound, and you get polynomial time. Nice. But here, we don't have this. We assume we have real number inputs, and we cannot bound it a priori. And if you look at the examples, in all the interesting examples, one might say, it turns out that actually computing this is as hard as solving. Okay, so this is kind of a dilemma. And a way out of a dilemma is, as Felipe already told us, is to do the following, to go for a probabilistic analysis. Okay? So, probabilistic analysis and, So let's first talk about average case analysis. So the idea is to randomize the data. Okay, we assume that we have some probability distribution, and then we try to show that well, it's unlikely that the condition of the random data is big. So we want to come up with a probability tail estimate, something of this form. We want to show that the probability that the, now I write it in very generality, you want to show that the probability that the condition of X is greater than some threshold T is bounded from above, say, by some power law, say n to a constant, t 1 over t to the alpha. Okay? So we have subdivided the problem into two parts, and this is was proposed by Steve Smale. He said, well, he sees much of the analysis of numerical algorithms as this two-part scheme, where in the first part you do the condition-based analysis. Okay, here, there is no probability at all. And in the second part, you try to answer this. Okay? Good. Right, so let's look at it. This is very abstract. So let's look at examples. So what can we actually say? So because the title of my talk is Probabilistic Analysis of Condition Numbers, I focus on the second part of the scheme. And what is the simplest case to look at? Well, of course, it's the classical condition number of a matrix. So let's take this, which is, by the way, quite interesting. I think. So we have a square matrix of real numbers. It is random, and the simplest assumption one can make, of course, it's standard Gaussian. So let's make this assumption. Standard Gaussian. So I like to denote it this way. This symbol is quite standard. So this means the mean of this distribution of the normal distribution is zero, zero matrix. Covariance matrix is the identity matrix. And this just means that all the entries of this matrix are standard Gaussian and they're independent. Okay. So now what can we say? How can we bound the probability that the classical condition number exceeds the threshold T? Okay, under this assumption. Well, okay, several people worked on it, and it's not my intention in this talk to cite all the people, okay? I'd rather like to give some ideas. The sharpest estimates that we know of this have been given by Alan Edelman in a paper published in 1988, and he proved the following. This is, actually, it's not just a big O, it's a theta, because we also have a lower bound. So this is n over t. And yes, very sharp bounds, but let's focus on this n over t. So we have this power law with exponent 1, and the exponent of the n is also 1. Okay. Immediate corollary of this is a bound on the expectation of the logarithm of the condition number. Maybe I did not motivate well why we are interested in this. This rather is more interesting in the context of finite precision. But let me nevertheless write it. So we get here logarithm of n plus some constant. And actually this is very, we know exactly what it is. Okay? Good. Second example. The second example is the condition number of the linear programming feasibility problem. What do we know here? So here A is, again, a real matrix, but it's not square. It has this rectangular shape over there. And again, we assume that it is a standard normal. Okay. Well, yeah, you have to interpret this right. So what can we say here about the probability that the GCC condition number exceeds T? Okay. So again, here, a lot of people worked on it. I don't want to cite them all, but just state what we get here. Yeah. Actually, I don't even want to write this. This is already too complicated. Let's keep it simple, because there will be many more talks today, I'm aware. So don't want to bother you with the details. But I hope maybe you can keep this in mind. Just want to say some bound on the expectation of the logarithm, because the logarithm of this is important for the interior point method. So, okay. So there was a paper among many papers by Danek and Spielmann and Tang, and they showed that one can have such a bound. Which is, this is Danek, Spielmann, Tang. Actually, it was a corollary of something, okay, strongly proved. So you can see it's quite analogous to this here. And as a consequence, okay, we get an interesting consequence. For the interior point method, we see that the expected running time of the interior point method that I quoted above is O square root of n log n. Okay. So this is a nice result, I would say. It's a strong bound. Maybe I can mention here that this can be even improved. So you can maybe one and can prove this to log m. So n is the number of inequalities, m is the number of variables, and the O also, okay, it's better. And this was in a joint paper with Felipe and Martin Lotz. by itself interesting, but it doesn't have big consequences on the analysis of the interior point method. Okay, so this average case analysis, I mean, if you talk to people in numerical analysis, they are not too convinced about this, because they say, well, this is very theoretical. The input that you get is not, doesn't make sense. I mean, it's never a random matrix. So the question, is there a way of arriving at more convincing statements from a theoretician's point of view? And there is. Okay, and now let's move to this concept of smoothed analysis, okay, which can be seen as a refinement of average analysis. So it was introduced by Spielman and Teng, I think the first paper was published in a conference in 2001. Many of you will already know about it, but it is my duty to explain it here in simple terms. So I think you can even explain it to your grandmother. It's really simple. Assuming that she's not a mathematician. So we have some, of course, otherwise it's trivial. We have any function t going, say, to the non-negative reals. It might take the value infinity. It measures the running time of an algorithm or the condition number or whatever you like. Okay? Then, what do we do now? When we do average case analysis, we make some assumption on the distribution, and this is somehow a distribution that is spread out over the input space. Now we want to depart from this view, and we take the following viewpoint. We have some input x bar. Okay, and this input x bar has some perturbation in it. There is some noise, or rounding errors, or whatever. So we have some local perturbations here, okay, with a certain variance sigma squared. Okay, this we can measure, and okay, the most natural way is to measure this by assuming that x follows the law of a normal distribution. So I assume x is Gaussian with mean x bar, and I assume it's isotropic with variance sigma square. So this is Gaussian. Between x bar variance sigma square and isotropic. Okay, so I have these local perturbations, and then I want to bound the probability that t of x exceeds the bound small t under this assumption here. And I want to prove that this is small. But the point is, I want to have a bound that is independent of the x bar. So actually, I want to bound, if I take the supremum here over all x bar, I want to bound, show that this is small. So, and if I can do that, I'm happy. Okay, and what have I, you see, one has to realize that even if the x bar is ill-conditioned, so the value of t on this x bar could be infinity. It could be like the case of the matrix, it could be a singular matrix. We still hope to prove that this is small. Okay? So in words, one can even say it in words. It means if you can do that, you show that for any x bar, the probability that the slight perturbation x of x bar, okay, for any x bar, the probability that under a slight perturbation of x bar, the t is big, is small. Okay, more or less. Right. Good. Of course, Spielman and Teng, they not only did this definition, they also proved something. And they came with this idea and applied it to the simplex method, very famous algorithm. They were successful. Well, for the simplex method, with respect to a certain pivot rule, they could prove that we have smooth polynomial time. Okay, and this has created a lot of attention. This work and the follow-up works, and they received the Gödel Prize 2008 and the Fulkerson Prize 2009 for this work and the follow-up work. So in my talk, I don't want to speak about the simplex. Somehow doesn't fit too well into this overall framework because we don't have this. It's not clear that we have these two part step. I don't know exactly what is the condition there. It's more combinatorial. But what one can notice is this concept perfectly fits well to these two part schemas of Swale. The first part of the condition based analysis is just you leave. Nothing has to be done. Okay? If you have done it, you can still use it. The only thing you have to do is you have to modify the second part here. Okay, so it's just here. Instead of doing an average case analysis, instead of this, you do this. Okay, so this is very natural. In Spielmann and Teng, they wrote a paper which was published at the ICM 202, and they already proposed this as an interesting research direction. Okay. So, good. So let's look at this. What can we say? What in our example? So let's look at the example of the matrix condition number, which is the simplest example. So what do we get here? Now, maybe I should... Oops. Yeah, there isn't. No, this is not good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's try here. No, it's also not at the door. It's nice to have three boards here on each side, but you need to learn how to deal with it. Okay. So the example of the matrix condition number. Yeah? So what do we have? We have any matrix, A bar, real matrix, n by n. I assume that its norm is bounded by 1. This is quite natural here because we have conic setting. Okay, I have some sigma between 0 and 1. And now I want to see a statement. I want to prove that the probability that the matrix condition number is greater than or equal to t is less than something, and this bound should hold for any A bar of norm at most 1. Okay, so now you can't see anymore what Edelman proved. It's hidden, but I'm sure you remember. right. So Mario Szabor, again, several people worked on it, but Mario came up with the best estimates that we know of today. And what he proved is the following. So Aaron Edelman had this bound here, you remember. And if you go to the smooth case, you just have to add here a sigma. Okay, that's... Okay, and we will, I think, later on maybe we will even see why. So this was proved by Mario Szabor. 204. Mm-hmm. Yes, sure. I mean, if you... So, I mean, you get Edelman as a corollary.
Yeah,
you get A bar equals 0. You assume A bar equals 0. And sigma
between 0 and 1.
Then for Edelman, no, in Edelman it doesn't make sense actually to talk about the sigma because the problem, you know, this is scale invariant. So actually, you see, you can take any sigma; it will not change the result. for if A bar is, right. So maybe this is a little bit confusing here to what maybe one should say, talk about, okay, one should maybe this introduce as a relative measure and say the variance is this, but then it kind of messes up the formula. People do it like this and I stick to that. Okay? And again, without any work, one immediately gets bound on the expectation of the logarithm of the condition number. Well, again, it's a supremum, but maybe I should write a supremum. And this will be log n plus log 1 over sigma plus. Okay? Good. You can see this is a whole program. And the next example, of course, now the question is how much time do I have? Of course, the next example I should talk about is linear programming. So what do we get? So where was it? Yeah. Maybe I can save some space by just using color. Yeah? So here, on this board, we had the analysis of the GCC condition number, linear programming. Maybe let's go back to the log n. And you may already guess what the right result should be now. I mean, I don't want to talk here about the tail estimates because it's a little bit more complicated. One can do that, of course. But looking at the picture, you would expect that if you do the smooth analysis, the only change that you would get is plus log 1 over sigma. Yes? And that's actually the case. Yeah? And this was proved. Actually, this was the result by Dunnigan, Spielman, and Tang, what they proved. And as a consequence, you get a smooth analysis for an interior point method. Yeah? And I think this is very nice. So maybe, I don't know, maybe it's not so popular. I mean, maybe in this community, yes, but simplex algorithm everybody knows. Interior point methods maybe are a little bit less known generally, but the situation is changing. But just looking at the mathematics behind, I think this is very nice. I think this can be understood well. If you ever took the paper by Spielman and Tang and tried to understand it, the statement, okay, look, well, it's easy to tell, but if you look in detail, it's quite complicated, if not horrible. That is quite complicated. It's really complicated. But here, for this, I think, with this separation into two parts, on the one hand, condition-based analysis, on the other hand, this probabilistic analysis that we are, I think, our understanding is increasing a lot. So I think it's quite a nice piece of mathematics now that can be understood. Okay, so... these were just general methodology, and I stated a lot of results, but so far I didn't give any idea about proof. So one should never give a talk without saying anything about the ideas behind. So now in the remaining time, unless there are questions, I would like to sketch now a little bit how one can actually prove such things. And of course I stick to the most simple, the simple situation of the matrix condition number values. Not too hard. Yeah? Two questions. Yeah, yep. Mike, I think you were first off. Sorry.
You could read this two ways. You could think, okay, your input is given in floating point numbers that represent a lot of matrices nearby.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's really some smooth matrix and things will work well. Or you could read it that even if you were in a pretty good situation, you might be disastrously represented by the floating point instance. Might be infinitely badly conditioned, even though your problem instances are good on average. Are both of these effects seen?
In practice?
Practice, yeah.
Well, I'm not a practitioner. Maybe you asked the wrong person for this.
This smooth analysis can have, two.
But what I understand is, of course, in practice you have these errors. They are there.
Yeah.
But I remember in a paper by Spielmann, he actually produces the error on purpose. It's for solving a linear system. It's quite impressive. The matrix is really bad. And he has a MATLAB program and it doesn't work. And then he produces the error on purpose. The result is good. So, I don't know if this answers your question. You had another question.
What about structured policies?
Structured.
Yeah.
That's a very good question. And that's a very good question, and that's right. Okay. I would say for the matrix condition number, we have now a couple of results telling us what happens in the case of structured problems. So you were not in Felipe's course, for instance. What is interesting, it turns out that the situation is not always like this. If you see this, you might get the impression, okay, it's getting boring. I mean, you always get the same kind of things. But for instance, I recall from Felipe's class. Okay, let's assume the matrix is upper triangular. Okay, random. Entries standard Gaussian. Average, huh? Average analysis. Then what you get here for the logarithm of the condition number, you get n, not log n. So the condition will be exponential in n. So very bad. So actually, it turns out if you go to the structure problem, then okay, I'm about to explain you some ideas of proofs and some. One of the ideas is you have this characterization of condition by inverse distance to ill-posed mass. This is not always the case in this structure setting, and this complicates these things a lot. So I would say it's not too well understood so far, but of course it's very important that one can understand it, because in practice the problems are structured. So I think we're still at the beginning here. Okay, so let's move to proof techniques. Let's see whether there is a board left. I think one. Okay. But don't worry, it will be very untechnical. Okay. So I would say, we have, on the one hand, we have direct methods. So what I mean by direct methods, like Edelman's result, what he did is, it's quite natural. You have a random matrix, Gaussian, and then we know a lot about it. We know the joint distribution of the eigenvalues since Wigner. So you can go to this. You work hard, and then you get very sharp results. So you use the special structure of the problem. Or Mario Szabor, what did he do? Well, maybe I don't understand everything he does, but here, because it's quite complicated and technical. But I understand he uses the Rice formula. It's a powerful tool from the theory of random fields, so forth. Or there is a paper by Sankar, Spielmann, and Teng, where they also analyze the matrix condition number. What they do is more elementary, but quite tricky, very nice and tricky. So now the question is, so I don't want to talk about this because then my talk will be very long because there are many, many tricks. I just want to talk about some general approach. Okay, there is some general approach of addressing these questions that, in one blow you... You don't get everything, but you get some understanding. And the starting point of this is the condition number theorem. So we have heard about this already many times, like Felipe talked about it, Jean-Pierre had it in his talk. And the condition number theorem gives the geometric characterization of the condition number. For the matrix condition number, it says the following. It's the Eckhard-Young theorem. It says the condition number is the norm of the matrix, spectral norm, divided by the distance of A to the set of ill-posed inputs, and sigma, let me just recall, the set of matrices of determinant 1. Okay, now we want to use this characterization. Okay, now here at this point I decided not to cheat. Maybe, because maybe it's not... Here, this is the spectral norm. So, okay, if you don't cheat, we say, okay, we relax a little bit. We replace this by the Frobenius norm. The Frobenius norm is just Euclidean norm. You think of the matrix as a vector. Sum of the squares of the entries and square root, and you have this divided by the distance. And then we are very lucky because here you can either take the distance in the spectral norm or in the Frobenius norm, it doesn't matter, you get the same. So I can put an F here if I want. Right, and this is this the right hand side here. Maybe let me denote it this way, like the Frobenius condition number. Ad hoc notation. This is now completely geometric, defined in terms of the inner product of on R to the n times n. Okay? So this I can use for this geometric analysis. I think now I need to erase some of it. Okay. So now look, right. So the condition number, also this condition number here, is scale invariant, yeah, by definition. So we can look at the following map. Okay, I remove here a zero, and I go to the sphere. Okay, I just map my matrix A to the matrix B, which is defined by scaling to norm 1. Okay? Makes a lot of sense. And then I can say condition number of A is actually Frobenius condition number, is the Frobenius condition number of B, and this is 1 over the distance of B to sigma. That is okay. It's mathematically correct. Right. How about the probability distribution? If you have here the standard Gaussian on A, it's clear because of the because it's isotropic, we get here the uniform distribution on the sphere. Okay? So now we can say, now you can rewrite the probability that kappa f of A is greater than or equal t with respect to standard Gaussian is of course the same probability over the B now uniform that this is greater than or equal t, but this is just the inverse distance of B to sigma. So this is just the probability that the distance of B to sigma is less than or equal 1 over t. Okay, now I need to make a drawing. Okay, so this is supposed to be a sphere. Okay, in this sphere, now I can see the sigma. Okay, not yet, but. Soon it will look like it. You will get stripes. Okay. Okay, this is... Okay, this is going to be a stripe, but... Okay, actually, this should be sigma intersected with the sphere. Right, and now there is this stripe, or cube, or I look at the set of matrices in the sphere that have distance at most epsilon, say, from a matrix in sigma. Okay? So we get epsilon cube, okay, T sigma. Okay, now there is, of course, you may ask, how do we measure distance? Here in this setting, we would measure distance by angles. Okay? If you look at this, this somehow is not quite, it's Euclidean, it's not quite the angle. Okay, if you look at it, there is a small difference. Okay, you have maybe to replace this by the arc sine over 1 over t, but t is big. Okay, you want to have tail estimates. So 1 over t is small, so I just ignore it. This little difference doesn't make a big difference. So I see this probability is the volume of the tube around sigma of radius 1 over t. Now, this is a little bit of cheating, but not too bad. Divided by the volume of the sphere. Okay, this is clear. Now, you don't need to know much about mass in order to figure out what is approximately the volume of this tube. First order approximation. Okay, here in this example, this you can explain to your grandmother, sigma is a curve. Okay? So what will be the area of this thing? It will be roughly the length of the curve times 2 epsilon. Okay? So this is now let me write the volume. Now instead of length, of course I have to write volume, but the volume is in one dimension lower because the sigma is a hypersurface. Name it the zero set of the determinant. So times 2 epsilon, so times 2 over t divided by the volume of the sphere. Plus, okay, lower order terms. Okay, now we see already, I should write it bigger. But we can see already quite nicely that the power law is 1 over t. So this is clear, it must be 1 over t. It's 1 over t because the codimension of sigma is 1. Okay? Now about this. Now we have to say, in order to proceed, we need to say something about the volume of sigma. Okay. Now, of course, so this, we are approaching algebraic geometry here, and which can help us a little bit in estimating or determining the volume of sigma. But actually, in this setting, we are over the real, so not a complex number, so complex algebraic geometry doesn't provide the complete answer. Yeah? So it's real algebraic geometry, but actually, what is extremely helpful here is integral geometry. Very nice, which tells you some general principles of integral geometry, very general principles, almost immediately tell you that you can bound this quotient, the volume of sigma by the volume this, by the degree of sigma. Okay? Many of you know that, of course. So this is very nice, I think. So if this is like the length of the equator. Okay, so if the degree of sigma is 1, it's an equator. Okay? If the degree of sigma is 2, okay, you have to multiply by 2. It becomes larger at most by a factor of 2, and so on. So, if you believe this, and we specialize to our situation, well, this is the zero set of the determinant. The determinant has degree n. So this is n. So what we get here, what we expect to get. Okay, so we get here 2n over t plus o of 1 over t. And that's exactly what is in Edelman's result. Okay. So these ideas, of course, are not new. Jim Demel, he published a paper, I think it's 1988, if I'm right. And the title of the paper was The Probability That a Perturbation of a Numerical Analysis Problem. No?
The probability that a numerical analysis problem
is difficult, yeah. So, okay, he worked out this idea. Well, for average analysis, in great generality, use the tools from integral and geometry, algebraic geometry, came up with general bounds, and it has many applications. Okay, very nice. To be honest, at that time, I was still very young. But if you go to the literature and read, there was a paper by Steve Smale in 1981. Some of you in the audience know well. The Fundamental Theorem of Algebra and Complexity Theory. And if you read this, you see many, many of these ideas are there. I mean, it's not all elaborated, but I mean the tubes, the integral geometry is all there. So then you understand where the ideas come from. Okay. So it's quite old. So he did, Demel had general results for average analysis. Okay. Now, of course, when you have seen this, and you are a believer in smooth analysis, then you would say, okay, what do we have to do? Okay. Then you would say, let's assume here is our X bar or A bar in our setting. And now we do the local perturbations. And if you like geometry, you would say, maybe let's forget for this setting about the Gaussian. Let's rather assume that our perturbation follows the uniform law in a disk. Okay, why not? And then what you have to do is, okay, you have to come up with estimates of these just pieces of the tube, just this. Okay, you have to bound the volume of this red thing, divide it by the volume of the ball, because you have to have relative estimates. And then it turns out that, I mean, all these ideas and so, you can push further, and you can come up with smoothed analysis estimates. Okay. This I don't know, because I know what paper you are talking about. Yeah. Okay. So this is very difficult. If you learn these things later on, you don't know what happened at that time.
Jim.
Jim. Thank you. Okay. So we can extend. So in a paper with Felipe and Martin Lotz, we wrote a paper which was recently published. We went through these ideas and extended it to the smoothed analysis, which is, I think, if you look at it, there are just some technical problems that you have to solve. Okay, I think my time is more or less over. Tomorrow, we continue with this, but it will turn out that these beautiful, nice ideas of geometry maybe are not so important for polynomial equation solving. Maybe, unfortunately, because I like it very much. What will be important will be the smoothed analysis of an n by n plus 1 matrix under a certain distribution which is not Gaussian but related to Gaussian. That's okay. But you will hear about it more tomorrow. Thank you very much.